Okay, I'm in the field here today. Oops, start over. I'll delete that. This is my mic. Okay, we're in the field here today with Rafael and Vicente Gomez, and I'm in their Pasadena home. And actually, it's kind of like a homecoming because these two brothers I almost grew up with in our neighborhood in Pasadena. And, you know, we were just talking before we got started, I'm 56, Rafael 61, Vicente's 65, and I mean, the years have really gone by. And I know that all of you listeners have read my self-sufficient home book. I interviewed Rafael in that book because there's a whole section on getting around. And these brothers are awesome bicyclists. Some people talk about getting out of the car, reducing our dependency on foreign oil. These are guys who are doing it. I mean, they're out on the bicycle just about every day. They're very instrumental in the racing scene in the state of California. And I want to have these guys tell me a little bit about their story, too. But thank you for being here, Vicente.
Yes.
Yeah, good. And Rafael.
Chris, it's great being with you this evening. We were looking forward to this.
Good. So you guys were both, Pasadena residents, lifelong bicyclists, Vietnam vets, and maybe each of you could tell me about your experiences and just getting started in the early days of bicycling, how you got into it, and what kept you into it. Because I mean, there's nobody quite like you two brothers in the Pasadena scene.
You know, when we were in our youth, 12 and 13 years of age, Vicente and my other older brother delivered the LA Times by bicycle. And
you guys were paper boys.
And at that time you delivered the LA Times, which was a very heavy newspaper. Each of us would carry about 100 papers. You had a spot where you'd pick up 50. So in our youth, cycling was a part of it. Not that we were competitive in anything. Could have been. But it was adventurous. And that was the part of Americana that in cycling young people had, they enjoyed it. It was part of coming of age in the 50s, and it was a great experience with that responsibility of having to get up in the mornings, have the bicycle running right, and to be able to know the route and then get back and go to school on time. And I was influenced by Vicente and another brother, and so our cycling was actually very innocent in that sense, the exploration, the youthfulness of it.
Were you doing it just to make money originally,
Originally, as kids, yeah. And of course, then there's a period of time where you transition, like a lot of American youth, from bicycles to automobiles.
Mm-hmm. And Vicente, were you the first paper boy in the family?
Yes, first to ride my bicycle. Yes.
What kind of bike were you riding way back when?
Balloon tires with one speed.
Yeah. So okay, so then you guys eventually you graduated to the 10 speeds, right? Tell me your age along the line here.
Well, you know, at that point, you consider that was our adolescence, cycling. And I think my brother and I did race against each other, and I had stitches put in my chin. But that was the real innocent cycling. It wasn't until we got back from Vietnam. I had an opportunity to go to work for a gentleman named Max Schick, who had a bicycle shop on Huntington Drive. And I was just back from Vietnam, and I got an opportunity to start putting bicycles together for, I believe, $8 an hour. And this Max Schick, cyclist would go by Huntington Drive at that time. I was an apprentice mechanic assembling 10-speeds, French ones at the time, Motovicons, and Italian Itel Vegas. And I can recall a day where Vince was already commuting from Long Beach State.
Not by bicycle.
By bicycle.
From Pasadena?
Commuting from Long Beach State.
Okay.
Not every weekend, but on occasional weekends. He had a Peugeot at that time, the PX10 model, which was very popular. It was a sturdy bicycle. Vince would ride about 30-something miles home and back, carrying a few things back and forth.
How long did that take you? Because we're talking, if you don't know the Southern California area, passing the Long Beach on a busy traffic day is going to take you an hour.
Back then when there were no bicycle trails.
Right.
So on the main road, on Rosemead.
He went down Rosemead.
All the way to Long Beach.
Wow.
And the plan was to get home before dark. That was your basic plan, right, because if you had never done it,
I mean,
you started early.
2.5 hours on the bicycle, right?
Right.
But you had to take a long break, so you go to 3 to 4 hours.
Wow.
You had to rest every now and then.
And doing it individually on the steel bicycles back then. Aluminum frames or carbon fiber frames had not come about. So that was after the Vietnam era. Vince was already back at Long Beach State. He was into the physical PE program there, a student there, and he was commuting. And I got the opportunity to go to work for this gentleman, Max Schick, at Cycle World in San Marino on Huntington Drive, which cyclists around know that road. It's a long stretch, beautiful stretch. And Max and I were standing in a doorway, and a group of cyclists dressed up in their cycling racing apparel, a group of men, were traveling westbound, and they went past the front of the bike shop, and he waved to them a few, but I was not introduced to competitive cycling in any way. That was like my first kind of flash at it. And I recall that my employer said to me, "See those racers, Raphael? Well, us old fat guys need to leave the bike racing to them young guys." And I thought to myself, I was only 23, I was just back from Vietnam, and how could I be an old fat guy already?
He was calling you one of the old fat guys, huh?
Yeah, like himself, us old fat guys. And that was an inspiration to me. And he even gave me my first real 10-speed. It wasn't a Talbega, and heavy at those times. And I rode it until it fell apart, and we changed components and things, and it started about there. That inspiration that I went back a year later, and I had a different bicycle, Windsor or something at that time, and he didn't even recognize me because I looked more like the cyclist that rode by the shop than the old fat guy that he was standing next to.
So what you're alluding to is the health benefit of bicycling. You can't keep on a lot of fat when you're doing that. Which one of you got into racing then first, like around the Rolls Bowl and so forth?
You did, Raphael?
Yes.
So how'd that happen?
I was competitive. It was a funny thing. The gentleman that I worked for gave me a 5-speed Triumph. A Raleigh Triumph. It had fenders, a chain guard, and all that. And I would ride from Pasadena to San Marino to go to work.
How many miles?
Oh, it was only a few, but in the process, there would be these young people going to Pasadena City College on their 10-speeds. And I was telling Vince, I'm able to beat these guys on these 10-speeds. And so when I got the transition to a 10-speed, I just started kind of experience cycling, and I think that's an important part that parents, I think people have to remember, or people that want to mentor somebody in cycling. Children have to experience the innocence of cycling, and even if they get hit by a car or whatever, God forbid, but it can happen. But when they just go out and have that imagination, I was Eddie Merckx, because he was a big star at that time when I was working in a bike shop.
Now, everybody may not know who that is. I don't know who Eddie Merckx is. Who is?
Cyclist from Belgium, and the standard by which cyclists like Lance Armstrong and Greg LeMond, American cyclists, would have always been measured to. He was the standard of greatness. So cyclists would inspire to be like somebody, and this European cyclist was like an idol. And of course, I just started this imaginary process, and I met a man about my same age, Jeff Spencer, who grew up in Pasadena and was an Olympic cyclist. And he said, "You know, I know your brothers, they went to Muir High School with me. You didn't go to Muir, and you know, your brothers were great runners. You know, Raphael, maybe you would be a pretty good racer." At that time, Vincent's influence really helped us going in that transition, because you see, when he was going to school at Long Beach State, they required these people in the PE program to wear a certain attire. And there were these like nylon coaching shorts. And we weren't exposed to cycling apparel at that time. So Vince got us the next best thing. He had these kind of like jersey-like looking things and these yellow pants that went with my yellow bike. But they weren't cycling apparel. They were like coaching equipment. But he helped me with this transition. And we were still riding in running shoes. When I did that event, I ended up taking fourth place down at the Rose Bowl. It was a 10-mile time trial, and I beat a lot of people. I came in third. I just missed the podium. I came in fourth place. A top rider beat me at the line from Montrose Bike Shop, a big, tall guy that was, you know, like a professional rider. But I was close, and not even having all of the equipment. That was when Jeff Spencer came up and said, "You know, Raphael, you know, you might want to keep at this because your brother's running experiences and all that. you might really like this.
Oh, that's right. I almost forgot your older brother. Tell us about your oldest brother who's the running.
Running myself.
Yeah.
And John Muir.
Okay.
And, you know, like you said, you ran for 3 years and then you graduated and went on. And when I went on, like, at Pasadena City College, I was commuting on my bicycle. A few years later after that, Raphael and I, of course, got together and started riding. And the point I want to make is that we started to ride. He decided to get a tandem. He decided.
To get a tandem.
Not me. So people say, well, where did it come about? The gentleman that Raphael was influenced by was Don Ferguson, former Olympian.
World-class tandem cyclist on the velodrome. Represented the United States. I had a bad crash in 1976 while doing a criterium in Santa Barbara, and I severed my right leg open at the knee. It was over 100 stitches. It was a really severe injury. I cut the sartorius muscle, the vein, the artery, and the collateral ligaments. So there were over 100 stitches in that injury. To come back from an injury like that in cycling, at that era, without all the concepts of therapy and training that we have today, you would have a primitive approach to therapy and all of that. I had a very dear friend, Don Ferguson, who owned a little bike shop on San Gabriel Boulevard. He was a one-man show, but he was a beautiful character and became my mentor and helped me along in road racing and all of that. And after the injury, he had said, you know, Raphael, I want you to go riding on a tandem with me. He had a beautiful racing tandem, a Folus Racing 531 Reynolds aluminum. Back in that era, that was the top of the line.
What year are we talking?
This would have been 76. I was trying to make my comeback from my injury right after 76, 77. And he took me for a ride down at the Rosebud. He was a big, robust fellow. He was a big gentleman. And he had gave me all the ins and outs when I rode with him at the Rose Bowl, and he told me about how difficult it was for a captain to control the bike if the rider in the back didn't have the finesse or faith in the captain. He goes, you have to have this. And all of this time he was, I guess, directing me to where we ultimately ended up winning national championship medals as masters riders at the elite national championships on the track, just like he had envisioned. I mean, if we had done it sooner, we probably would have been national champions because we were much bigger.
So when you guys did your bicycling competition, you were almost always doing tandem?
No, it started after that injury. It was sort of a therapy.
Okay.
Vince and I were riding together, and it was this therapy concept, but then it took on a life of its own on the road. Tandem riding was sort of a novelty, and it wasn't always considered so prestigious unless you had two top riders, whoever they would be, like up in Northern California, Otis Guy and Joe Breeze. They won the Davis 200 years on to end, which was a mountainous double century, and these guys were infamous, you know, for accomplishing this on a tandem. And of course we won a few double centuries, and we won the Hemet double as we started getting into this activity. But it was
A double century, for somebody who doesn't know, is
200 miles in one day. Yeah. And they do quads as well. Some ultra-distance riders will do 400 miles in 24 hours. But our specialty on the tandem was to attack 100-milers and 200-milers because we weren't really racers again. We were kind of doing these century rides. And
Fun rides.
Fun rides, okay.
They were not races. They were just people that went out that wanted to do it 100 miles.
And they're very popular now.
Men, women, and children.
Yes.
All
ages.
Started together. Brilliant. And you finish wherever.
There was a rider that even rode a penny farthing on the Davis double century, which is very mountainous. Now, I assume he had to push it up some of the steep grades, like the St. Helena grade up there in the Napa-Sonoma area. So, but just to give you the idea of the characters and all of that that these double centuries bring out. So we became very well-known in the double century and century circles because these were long events. And the gentleman that had sold us the tandem was another bike shop owner named Bill McCready, the builder and founder of the Santana Tandem Cycles. It's a really elite American company, one of the best tandem manufacturers, I would say even worldwide. His bicycles are known everywhere. He had sold us a couple of used tandems to get us started in this event. And one day we had gone to him to ask him about whether we would make it in the elite racing. And his comment to me was, just like that fat guy, the fat man in San Marino, he said, "No, no, no. You boys are just long-distance riders. You'll never be really top sprinters or top criterium riders. Just stick to the double centuries." If it hadn't been for Vince, he said, "You know what? Let's not listen to him." He said it in different words, but I think we have it in us. You know, let's not listen to him. Let's do it anyway. So Vince was really the one that influenced me to get the licenses and to really try to get into all the different aspects. We experimented with every discipline of competitive cycling. We did the time trials, and we did everything on the tandem as well. To be really professional, or let's say expert at level at any event, road racing or road riding, that's a discipline in itself. And then the criterium riding takes a different type of rider because it's very edgy, it's very high on pace, up and down, and a lot of turns. So some riders prefer road racing only, some prefer criteriums, and some will race on the velodrome. Those are the bicycles that are raced with no brakes. One selected gear on bank tracks, which we have one of the world's finest velodromes here in Dominguez Hills. The outdoor velodrome that 7-Eleven built for the 84 Olympics was demolished. And we have an indoor wood track here at Dominguez Hills, 220-meter track. They just had an event this last weekend. I'm not sure if it was a World Cup or not. But it isn't a mainstream sport still when you think of all that's available to the people. But getting back to the cycling, no, we ended up specializing in tandem racing. And we did every discipline available in tandem racing, time trials, road racing, hill climbs. And then we ended up on the velodrome, which was the ultimate, to race the double bikes on the bank tracks.
So how many years did you guys do tandem racing?
Well, we've been racing since 1973. Our first racing license was with the Amateur Bicycle League of America, the ABLA. The following year, it became the U.S. Cycling Federation. So we've been continuous members of the United States Cycling Federation, which is the amateur representation for the Olympic qualification and all of that, since 1973.
So you guys, again, lifelong bicyclists. We've got plenty of people that say they cannot get out of their car to go a mile down the street to go shopping. I mean, so what? When you guys go on your bike, it's like an extension of your body, right? I mean, is that kind of how you think of it? It's not like it's a big deal. For some people, they have to go in the garage, dust it off. Once a year, they're going to ride their bicycle. I mean, wouldn't you like to see this mentality come back to the United States, like perhaps in China, out of necessity? People are riding lots and lots of bikes, although I've heard that's changing because of the economic affluence, and now they're back, you know, now they're like us in the cars.
What's really wonderful is that there are some foundations now here in the U.S. that are working to put the people back in that mode. There is advocacy already in that direction. But as far as my brother and myself pointing out that our competitive cycling experience alone spans something like 4 or 5 decades, the 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000, and now 2010. The decades that we represented and influenced young people in our community about competitive cycling.
Well, when I mention the Gomez brothers to bicyclists, people know who I'm talking about.
And we hope that it's not just the accomplishment, because we had a really beautiful blessing, and it's called imagination. At one point or one time, I had a wonderful art teacher who also influenced me about pursuing cycling as an artist. Phil Cornelius, who was the art director at Pasadena City College, was my art mentor, and he recognized my art ability, and I was very blessed for his honesty. And he went to one of my first criterium bicycle races, which are these in-town circuits that the people get to watch, and it was down by City Hall. And I ended up getting crashed on the last lap and taking dead last. But he was so proud of me, and this is an art professor, not a PE teacher or anybody like that. because it was not a mainstream activity.
If I'm not mistaken, Phil Cornelius is really world-renowned as a ceramicist, right?
Truly beautiful human being. I was blessed to be a student of his because just in his presence, he allowed me to become so aware artistically. He was a blessing in my life. And after that first race, I was demoralized. He came up to me and he said, Raphael, I want you to remember one thing. Art is not just dancing, painting, or ceramics. I saw you dancing on the pedals. You have this passion for this activity, and you should pursue it with your artistic capabilities. The blessing that I got from him at that moment, from a professor of renownedness that he was, his talent, being around genius, to have him recognize what I was enjoying or trying to create for myself, was someone who recognized my artisticness. And I'm a closet artist. And I...
How do you mean that? How do you mean closet artist?
I was never the runner that Vince was or my other brothers. I was pudgier, right? So I was never really the athlete. They were state champions in high school. Runners to the core. They said the Gomez brothers in cross country, they knew Jess and Vince Gomez. They took Muir High School to state championships. And it was that Indian blood, the running blood. Knowing then at that moment that I had the artistic talent that I questioned because I wasn't college oriented. And I was back from Vietnam and now I at least had a blessing from a professor that what I was doing in cycling was truly artistic and I was told to pursue it. And that's where it really blossomed in terms of like knowing how to write proposals for sponsorships and doing unique events. I channeled us to all kinds of different activities that got us a lot of exposure, and plus we had a lot of fun doing like the human-powered speed events and things like that on a tandem. So the tandem was our vehicle that we were able to use because it wasn't the imagination of what it represented, two brothers. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, I think one thing I want to share with you now is my artistic friend that you are, and I posed it to somebody, and it might have been you. I said, you know, we ride the steel ponies.
Yeah, I like that. You guys with the Yaqui heritage, you know, the Indian running heritage,
and
the Apache pony.
So you asked me about these people that are sitting at home. So what is their inspiration? You have to have imagination, and it starts with, you know, believing. And people ask me, there's no such thing as faith. Well, there truly is, because it builds on a belief. And if the belief, like science, can have foundations of truth real to the individual, they can expound on that. So here I was, an artist, using this energy as... I didn't even realize we were the Yaqui warrior. I had a glimpse of our spiritual awareness of who we were, but at the moment, I was that artist. And I used it. I was an artist that became a cyclist, not an athlete projected into cycling. So it was kind of a unique direction that we got. It was very artistic for, let's say, the avenue of expression. And I think that's what people should seek out when they, well, what is he talking about? Well, if you have a bicycle in the garage, don't go out and buy a new one. Have it. The tires checked out, see if the tubes are okay, and ride what you have. Be proud that you're strong enough to go out and experience the ride for what the little bicycle represents. Let that childish imagination emanate now when people need it. How do we find it? Do we look for God out there? No, we need to look for God because he's helping us from within. And the spirituality and riding the steel pony was my inspiration. There was never
a way
that I was afraid of because I was riding.
So in a way, you were actually visualizing your being in the old days riding your pony,
exactly.
Getting around.
Because it was at the era that we were riding, as I told you earlier before we went on air, we were riding in an era where cycling was not as mainstream as Lance Armstrong has made it today in the new era. People would throw things at you, try to run you off the road because there were not as many then as there are today. And it was a smaller cycling community, so there was... And it was even segmented, touring and racing and this and that. But mountain biking helped make these transitions because The bicycle style, the mountain bike style became very popular for the people that were more comfortable on riding on upright bicycles. Now they've morphed into these city bikes, and all these manufacturers have these beautiful bikes that are set up lightweight with a lot of gears for somebody that wants to ride in the upright position.
So in a sense, there's no excuse not to get out on a bicycle also.
You know,
hey, let me ask Vicente, did you have the same feeling of the spiritual awakening while being on a bicycle too, like bringing your roots alive? Maybe
when you're riding, sometimes you just go off into your own imagination. I tell people you're like meditating. And when you're riding, if you're on a tandem, and you're on the back, you don't have to control anything other than turning the pedals.
Right.
So that allows you to truly go inward. Yeah. You're out there for 4 hours or five just riding down a highway from Sacramento to wherever next. And with all that beautiful scenery from Bakersfield or wherever, and you're looking at the train coming down the road and the smoke blowing out and it's going to hit you, but you're in a different world. And your brother says, look, what's going to happen? We have to get off the bike or do what? What do we have to do? But the point I'm making is it's so hot and humid, but we're in our own little world, in our own little imagination, and we're at peace with this.
Yeah, I'm just thinking, like, two guys, you guys have to be right in sync on the traveling that you would do. Your minds are in sync. You're probably even thinking the same thoughts, you know, with your ups. Heritage, with where you're going, with everything. I mean, it seems like a very spiritual experience.
Yes, it's a very spiritual experience, but you have to experience it yourself to understand it.
You can't experience it on YouTube and get the idea?
Like you said, you can read the book, but it'll never be the same as experiencing the feeling yourself. To go off into this imagination in a world of your own, and you're there with your other partner, but you're allowed to free yourself from everything around you.
Right.
And for a few hours, you're gone until someone taps you and says, hey, you got to go a little harder, you got to slow down, or whatever.
So bicycling will save gas, it'll make you feel healthier, it'll also be a form of self-therapy. This is kind of what you're saying.
It goes beyond that. I think the one thing when people say, oh, the Gomez brothers, I mean, infamous, sometimes not famous, but we've been known to get into fisticuffs, but people knew that they were dealing with the brothers. It wasn't a one-on-one deal. The beauty of this is really what I'm getting at is that brotherhood, and tandem riders create this brotherhood. The partners, if they don't have a brother, they have a partner that trusts them. The beauty of our experience on the tandems, I didn't realize until one day at Visalia, we were doing a special race in front of the professionals and all of that. And this gentleman brought his two little boys up to us, and he said, sir, Mr. Gomez, my son wants to talk to you. And he asked us for autographs. And the father said, my sons love you. And I remember another professor named Chester Kyle, a gentleman that worked with human-powered vehicles, an engineer of the highest degree. We had to compete against him. So when I say I know this gentleman, I knew him as a professor and also as a fellow competitor. And that sometimes is a turmoil. But he had these two beautiful little boys. And he passes in his MGB one time going down Long Beach. We were riding on, coming around Coast to Coast Highway on a road. And he passes in his MGB and his two little boys with their blonde reddish hair was flowing in the wind. And all of a sudden, I saw the brake lights go on. And he pulled over. And I said, Vince, I wonder what this is. And Chester Kyle stepped out of the vehicle and he said, my boys demanded that I stop so that they could speak with you. The beauty of this is that we have inspired other brothers. What it means to be brothers, to stick by each other. And that was what people would, that was the edge. They would always complain, well, they're brothers, they can beat you because they're brothers. They have this innateness that bonds them. You know,
but brothers don't always do that, do they?
No. So what we were able to really show people with tandem racing was really the ultimate in it. A crazy guy in the front steering through anything, and the guy in the back just pedaling his butt off because he has total faith in that guy.
The crazy guy in the front?
Was you,
Vicente? No.
You were in the back.
Yeah, I was on the back.
So you were the crazy guy in the front.
They call me the bad brother.
Okay. So, you know, I didn't think to ask this, but were you guys tight as children? Or did bicycling bring you really closer?
No, we were very close.
That's good. That's good.
Ben saved my life as a child. Like at Devil's Gate Dam, you're familiar with the reservoir area. It had like quicksand like places back in our days.
Still does sometimes.
Yes, especially after the rains like today. No, Vince pulled me out of the muck and saved my life. I was going down for the count. So, no, our bond was very deep. And when I had spinal meningitis, Vince had come home from Long Beach State one of those weekend days. The Hong Kong flu was going around that time, and everybody was just saying, oh, you're just being a big sissy, you just have the Hong Kong flu. Well, actually, it was 72 hours into the critical stage of spinal meningitis when Vince got me into the car and took me to the emergency, and they said, if you'd waited, he would have died. So there's been several times, and probably more than that, that Vince saved my life. I just don't want to go into all the other ones.
Yeah.
I feel so indebted.
Well, that's good. You know, I'm kind of glad we touched on some of this, because when we think of the traditional Native American culture that was largely destroyed as the continent was colonized, there are these principles that people think of as the old ways traditions. And I think your bicycling, because it's self-reliant power, the bicycling it falls right into that pattern. And part of it is family. Part of it is traditional foods, you know, relying on the family. I mean, I think you guys really epitomize some of these traditional old ways. Even though we're in the city, you know, even though we've got the cars and the houses and everything all around us. And Vicente, we were talking a little bit earlier about diet. And I don't know if the bicycling has affected your diet, but maybe you could speak on traditional foods and how you feel that affects us, you know, the food choices that we make and what it does to us.
Well, the best I can come to conclusion to say to you is that when I first came back from Vietnam, I was suffering very severely, and no one would accept my suffering, even the Veterans Administration. I had been poisoned by Agent Orange, and I had to deal with this on my own. I had to cleanse my body on my own because no one could give me answers.
How did you know you had Agent Orange?
Well, it's kind of like at the time I was in Vietnam, they were using this stuff everywhere, and they had barrels, and I'd take pictures of them, and when they saw my pictures, they took them away, so I realized something was wrong. Mm-hmm. But very few people could comprehend the situation at the time. It took 10 years later before they realized what had been done to them. And during that particular time, I saw we were sprayed directly. And so a lot of people were directly affected. Mm-hmm. So when I came home, I had depression. I wanted to kill myself.
When did you guys come home? What year approximately?
1969.
69, okay.
And right after that, I had a hard time dealing with it because the depression was so bad. Mm-hmm. And most people could never get over that level. So that's when you said, what I ate made the difference to get to where I am today. Mm-hmm. Vitamins, nutrients, cleansing yourself, using ginseng. People say, what does ginseng do? And I said, well, the most important thing you must remember is that ginseng is a blood purifier. So it purifies your blood. It cleanses the blood. It's like as if they put you on dialysis. But this is a natural cleanser, which isn't necessarily safe for everyone, but some people can use it and get by. And there are all kind of other herbs, and you have to try a little bit at a time, kind of test it on yourself, and before you dare go any further than that, and see the effects. So as time went on, I had went to different plants and seen the effect it had on me, and as I would work out, I'd see my energy level change until my brother, he would ask me what I was doing, what did you do for your energy level, and I would explain it to him. And plus we had to load up on antioxidants. We didn't know at the time what we were really doing, as more as now we look back on it and we're able to realize we helped our own situation improve by what we ate.
Mm-hmm. And maybe what you didn't eat too, right?
And what we didn't eat.
Because, a bicyclist need a lot of protein, so you ate a lot of meat, right?
Which we know we didn't do. We were both vegetarians.
Both vegetarians. You guys were vegetarians. I want you to talk about that.
Vince got us on the direction of vegetarianism. I can remember going to the burger stands. We ate menudo, we ate chorizo, so we were raised like all the other Indians, to be honest with you, to consume. You know, our mother was a great cook. and meat was part of the diet. But like Vince was suffering when he got back from Vietnam, and I was back later. I didn't suffer in the same sense what he was going through, the depression, and what the different illnesses that it brought on. As we were riding, and Vince was using different cultures, like this Hungarian culture called Boogaloo.
What do you mean culture?
It's a portion of the testicle of a bull. And it's steamed in milk, and it makes a yogurt.
Okay, so it's a yogurt product.
But it's a very potent one, from Hungary. It was the concept. So Vincent was experimenting because he was running marathons. Vince was cycling, I was racing, but Vince was running marathons. That was his specialty. And you know, we're not that light African structure. We're pretty big guys. So he wasn't your typical marathon runner, but he was capable with the ginseng in going in that direction. He had said to me, "Raph, because we were looking for how do we maximize our performance? We're just stuck somewhere. We were at a plateau." And he said, "We need to improve our weight to strength ratio." And he said, "We need to start losing weight. We're way overweight, you know." And the ginseng was getting us in that direction. And he had said to us that at that point, we said, "No, I think we got to start cutting out the pork and the beef. We got to stop eating the hamburgers and eating the meat, the menudo, and all of that." So Vince instigated that. Well, that's the direction we're going to go. This is a very, and his experimentation was what helped us, because we weaned ourselves. You have to understand, there was one experience that kind of lit an epiphany experience. We were watching the Raiders football game in the Los Angeles Coliseum, and there was a riot. These men that were dressed Raider fans were beating up on the other team fans, and their defense was that they consumed too much alcohol and hot dogs.
And I said, sounds like the Twinkie defense.
I told Vince, this is a volatile combination. Let's be real about this. This violence stems from the intake of the meat. And we were not joking. This is an epiphany experience that I realized where Vince was directing us.
So in general, basically the alcohol and the heavy meat consumption, you believed that this would lead to violence. Was there, you said there was a transition from meat, was it a hard transition, Vicente?
Very hard.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, the only reason I made it, because I had met an Indian that told me, "You are what you eat." And I kept trying to swallow those words, but it was hard because I loved my chicken and fish. And with a little bit of time, I'd wean myself off to say, "Well, what is going to be the effect now that I'm off?" Well, my brother and I are now 40-something years into this, and I tell people, it's a personal choice. It's a conscious effort. And not everyone can make a conscious effort. It's not just changing your diet. You have to change within yourself your conscious direction, whatever your direction, so you don't tell anyone anything.
Vegetarianism, it's mocked.
True, a lot of people make fun of it because they say they don't know what they're doing. But what I'm getting at is, so you dropped certain meat products little by little, and then did you experience, were you weak when you bicycled at first when you weren't having meat, or did you substituted something to get your protein, right?
The ginseng at the time, like Vince said, the ginseng was helping us to burn fat, because, you know, there's enough fat on your body that the ginseng, because it's a blood purifier and it intensifies body temperature. So it allows you to reach a higher body temp, which the essence of working out really is. It's dangerous. Bruce Lee was the epitome of the capability of ginseng implemented into your daily diet. He was the fastest man on earth.
And he died in his 30s, right? I don't mean that to ridicule Bruce Lee,
no.
He was a very intense individual.
He went too far.
Like Vince, we're non-Asian Native Americans using Asian ginseng, not North American ginseng. Let me clarify that.
Okay.
There are several types of ginseng. The North American ginseng is considered a light red ginseng. Siberian ginseng is considered a white ginseng because it's almost clear. The Korean red ginseng, which Bruce Lee took, is known as the 100-year... It's not made from any roots less than 25 to 100 years. So the extract that comes from the ginseng of those roots is, we believe, is the strongest.
So that's the ginseng that you guys use, Korean red ginseng?
Yes, Korean red.
And you consider that the best?
The best. And well, I'm not saying that the other ones don't have their value, but for what we were seeking and what Bruce Lee epitomized was what ginseng has done for the Asian people, their longevity, their maintenance of mental capability, all of that balance that they're able to maintain. Their diet isn't always perfect, but ginseng really is the antioxidant that could make a difference in people's lives. But like my brother said, not everybody's lives. When we were making this transition from no beef, no pork, no chicken, no fish, and Vince doesn't eat any milk products. I'm what they call pseudo-lacto. I still drink low-fat milk and sometimes some Swiss cheese. But the point being is, like he said, the consciousness of moving away from the consumption of animals. I think at the brothers, I can only tell you, we were mountain bike racers and riders long before the sport really took off, when we were working for Sportula in the mid-80s. And we were riding up in the mountains to Mount Wilson long before the throngs are today. It's just it's crowded because it's a popular activity. And it was beautiful until they burned it down. But Vincent and I would have deer cross our path and walk very close to us. The point I'm saying is that when you change your diet and you're no longer consuming animals that have been butchered, killed, your body emanates a different odor. All right.
And it was so in other words, what you're saying is even the wild animals were not frightened of you because they didn't detect you. Or
they would come really close to us, and we were mountain biking in pristine conditions. Like I said, we would maybe occasionally see another rider. That's because the sport was only taking off. So we really enjoyed it when it was young. And here in the Mount Wilson region, and we would have these beautiful creatures come close to us. And Vince said, look, if we smelled like we consumed meat, they wouldn't come close to us.
Well, tell me, though, so ginseng was one of the nutritional secrets, the
yes.
Korean red ginseng. Were there other foods that you had to consume to get your necessary proteins?
Bee pollen.
Bee pollen, okay.
Protein.
So that you buy that from the beekeeper, it's little yellow granules, and you mix it?
Okay. You can get it, like you said, where you can get it, but the health food store has it in the frozen department.
So bee pollen, were there other protein-type food? I'm curious what your diet is like.
Soy, beans. Nuts and beans, legumes, nuts, a lot of protein from the nuts.
So really, a traditional vegetarian diet, but as racers, you guys may need an extra kick. So you're getting that from your ginseng and maybe your bee pollen.
When you speak of the plants and the flowers in the garden, you're aware that there's more there than meets the eye. When you say the term herb, now you're going to go deeper, that certain plants have certain traits that allow you to enlighten your mind, your energy, feel your health, get rid of a cold. And if you knew all these plants, you have everything at the fingertip. Yeah. You don't have to go to no market, nowhere, no internet, no anything. You would have it all there. And when you start to consume these certain herbs, Raphael and I would test. Raphael, one of his favorites was Mo Wong. And a lot of people would die if they hear you say that.
Is that a Chinese name?
It's one of the most controversial. Yeah, so you understand. But when you tell us,
athletes can't use that anymore.
We learned plants that could do wonders, but it could kill you at the same
time. Yeah, you have to be careful. Look, Bruce Lee is a classic example. He developed what is called toxic neurosis. That's really what killed him. He was so elevated in his energy level, he wasn't able to slow down and come back to a normal human 24-hour sleep pattern. So ginseng, it can be dangerous for individuals if they don't know how to have a balanced diet. And we're not saying don't eat protein. We're just saying don't eat animal protein.
Now,
You know, if that's what your beliefs are. But everyone, like Vince says, everyone needs to choose their path. Athletes, especially, it's difficult. Like you said, what are the combinations? There was this one item that you wrote about a long time ago called Dragon's Milk. It was a combination of different powders that were like wheat germ and different stuff.
I wrote about it?
Yes. It was back then. It was called Dragon's Milk. Okay. That's how it was. That's how interesting. And then it changed the name to a more commercial, Endurance One. That was one of the real antioxidant manufacturers that was really athlete oriented. I mean, not the normal. Maybe bodybuilders were the only other people that would use this type of item. We were fortunate because Vincent's experimentation and his herbology, that we went in that direction and we tried antioxidants, different ones with protein. Gatorade, Powerade, don't get me wrong, they're antioxidants and they try to help the body. They have all the different sodiums and stuff like that. But there are different directions to go as well. Those are commercial brands, real commercial.
Do you guys try to avoid commercial sugars in your diet, or has that come up?
We use honey.
Honey, okay, good. So you have the bee pollen and the natural honey,
the
okay.
Nicholson family. I'm sure you remember the Nicholsons in Pasadena?
Beekeepers?
He was the one who would make the giant beard with bees. Did you ever see it?
His
picture came out in the Star News. If people could look up the archives of the Star News, Pasadena Star News, and go back, let's say, 1957 or 60, they would find photographs of Mr. Warren Nicholson. And he was a local beekeeper in town. And he canned all the clover and different types of buckwheat, the different honeys. And his son was a dear friend of mine. That's why I knew a little bit about the honey business. It was a great local. I think another thing about bee pollen, I think it's best to take local bee pollen, not something imported from Germany or Spain. But if that's all you can get, remember that bee pollen is also considered a total food. You could consume that. But people are intimidated because consumption is an oral fixation. And you have to also get away from that. It's difficult. It's called changing the script of life. That's probably, I think, our biggest accomplishments for ourselves, to recognize our Native American heritage and to expand it with the knowledge that we had from assimilating and going in a direction representing brothers to young people.
Like I say, these are all of the principles that I think everybody ought to try to emulate in whatever fashion they can. You know, I was thinking about the white sugar. You guys have probably heard the study where a lot of the Native Americans who quickly went to a quote-unquote white man's diet, white sugar, white flour, well, they had a high degree of obesity and diabetes. And I forgot which groups in the Southwest they studied, but when they went back to their traditional diet with the cactus, you know, with the honey products, with the natural seeds and grains, the health went way back up. But unfortunately, we're like, you know, you guys are like fighting against the tidal wave of ignorance and of greed that drives our economy. And the interesting thing to me is that it isn't expensive to do the right thing. It's simple. You like it. You enjoy it. Your body feels good. You naturally respond to doing the right thing and eating the right foods. And this is real self-reliance, you know, not having to go out and buy something.
There was a gentleman that just ran the L.A. Marathon. He called himself the Fat Man. He weighed over 400 pounds. And he was an inspiration to me because you have to believe in yourself. It all comes down to that. If there is such a thing as faith, direction, you find it by being honest with yourself and looking at it as inch by inch. So you have to bring it down to that micro type of attitude. If I'm going to accomplish this, I need to believe in myself, the same way we believe in you, Christopher.
Hey, thank you. Hey, that was nice. Any other words on diet that you can think of? Any other foods that you want to share with the listener? You've got maybe another minute today.
Only that you keep always in mind what was once said to me, you are what you eat.
Yeah.
Experience it, feel it. Because many people will point out, Vince, I tried being a vegetarian for 5 years and didn't notice a thing. And the first thing Raphael says, did you ever smell your breath? No. And I don't mean to be foul or negative,
The
person never gave me any clear answers as to what did he notice? What was he able to observe? keep that in mind.
Yeah. Okay, you know, it's been great talking with you guys. So this is the Rafael and Vicente Gomez, the bicycling brothers of Pasadena. And I hope the listeners tie all of these seemingly diverse things together. We're talking about, you know, through bicycling, through your roots in bicycling, you were able to learn about your heritage, learn about some of the old ways that brought you guys together, nutrition, ways to think. I mean, this has been incredible, and I hope we can do it again sometime as well.
It's just great being recognized by someone of your expertise. They recognize what we did accomplish, because it, being Native Americans, we weren't at the forefront of any popularity, to be honest with you. And being the Gomez brothers, we do represent a different direction. And we are available to help anybody. And I think anybody can come to Pasadena, and we'll help people with cycling, with the Rose Bowl and things like that, which we've always advocated for, but good health and brotherhood.
Yeah.
Brotherhood.
Well, good. And if anybody wanted to reach you, then my website is on the station's website, and they could contact me that way. Yes. Thanks also.
Thank you. Hey, that's great.
All right, so we're checking out now.